We're going to continue on in our study, and I just review a little bit. Last time we finished up the fourth parenting detour, which was disobeying our duties as husband and wife. And we spent a lot of time on that. And I do want to share something with you this morning that that I found from Dr. Hobbs. I'll get to in a minute. But just remember, we talked about how as a husband and wife, there's biblical principles like, you know, leaving and cleaving. We talked about that a little bit, that, you know, you're I got very specific and gave examples from my marriage. And I think Mr. Opeger told Megan that we're learning out, finding out a lot about Adam and Megan's life and marriage, aren't we? And she's like, oh, boy, you know. So anyway, we talked about a variety of things that, you know, you're husband and wife now. It's not your, I mean, you are your father and mother's daughter or son, but technically you're more the wife or husband now. And the relationship changes. And we talked about the dangers of some of that, you know. And I remember even teaching high school classes, and we talk about this and things that, you know, you can go to your parents for advice, no problem. But if it becomes, and I've talked about with this with Megan and I, you know, Megan has never called her mom and said, you're not going to believe what Adam wants to do, or you're not going to believe what happened. We got in a fight about this. That should never, ever be a solution. To call mommy and cry and whine and complain about what's going on. Your answer to your husband, you're with your wife now. You have to lead. Don't, you know, you can call, yes, I need advice, Dad. I need to know what to do here, Mom. Great. But, you know, to kind of talk against each other or talk down about your spouse to friends, to family, to anything, it can really hurt. I had a teacher in high school that would teach some of these life skill type classes from a biblical perspective. And he said things that just kind of stuck with me. One of them was, that was kind of, as a high school student, it really kind of drove to me, and that was, don't ever disrespect your parents in front of your friends. Like, don't talk down to your parents. And that really kind of hit me a little bit, you know. I was like, man, you got to be careful with that. Yeah, you know, I mean, my dad and I, we joke around a lot. We have a great relationship, a lot of fun when I was growing up. We have some fun times together, but I was always had to learn to be careful. Yeah, I can joke around with my dad, but I better not, you know, do that in public or what. You know what I'm trying to say? Nothing bad, just something that might come across as demeaning. Or, you know, I'm going to go talk bad about my husband, or I'm going to go talk bad about my wife. You got to be careful with those things. I know, you know, sometimes we joke around and things like that. It's fine, but be careful with that. It's you two together now. It's, you know, you leave father and mother. Mommy and daddy, you leave them. You don't answer to them anymore. And they don't have to answer for you anymore. They've raised you. They've done the job, hopefully, line upon line, precept upon precept, and given the truth and the training, and even sometimes the rod of correction. And when they're old, they won't depart from it. Those vivid memories that come back about the rod of correction. But we won't go to that. I told you before, I had my mom's bed sheet memorized when she said, go to her room and wait for me. And just standing there staring at it, waiting for the pain to come upon me. And but anyway, and then Dad got home and it was back to the bedroom again. Some of you know about that because he wanted to make sure Mom did it right. I was like, Dad, she really got me good. You don't have to read. Yes, we do. All right, okay. Yep, good. Anyway, it's you're married now. And we talked about, you know, the marriage roles. Husband is to lead. We talked about the wife as well last week. But here's just review some of these qualifiers. How do you lead? That's the thing. What should hone in the type of leadership you should have of a husband? It should be the way Christ and the church have a relationship. And all of these verses and these points up here are from Christ and the church. So as you lead, it should be a self-sacrificing. I wanted to share with you something that Megan found it this week. She's been going through the CBC and files and finding all kinds of treasures down there. And I've really enjoyed reading some things. This is from a teacher's conference in 1984 that Dr. Hobbs gave. It's just phenomenal. It's all typed out word for word on looks like an old typewriter. Kind of neat. But on one particular part of this, and I printed out this one page kind of in the middle of it because I want you to have it. We're going to just quickly read through it. I want to read through this because Dr. Hobbs is talking about education. And he's talking about how selfishness really hinders education. He's talking about, I don't have all the other pages, but I'm trying to give you a prelude. He's talking about how selfishness with a child can hurt education, and selfishness with a teacher can hurt education. And he uses the example of marriage to talk about this. And I just wanted to quickly read through this as page number 5. All right. It just talks right up in the front here. He's talking about, you know, people think that marriage sometimes is a 50-50 proposition. It's not. It's a 100-100 proposition. There's no such thing as 50-50 working. It just doesn't. The proposition that works is me giving 100%, my spouse giving 100%. If a marriage works, the husband looks after the wife. His concern is for the wife. His care is for the wife. His interest is the wife. Seeing that she is happy, seeing that she is what she needs, seeing that she is looked after, not just in material things, but emotionally in every way, seeing about her, attending her, looking after her, that is love. That is exactly what the Bible says. Now, I'm telling you, I didn't get that when I first got married. I'll be honest with you. I didn't get that. You have to learn into that. And you know, it's all about her now. It's not about, you know, oh, what about my parents? What about them? What about my friends? What about them? It is 100% you are caring for, and when you stop doing that, you will have problems. And many times, sadly, in our world today, all this divorce and stuff, it's because it's not this 100-100. And when we get off track there, and then we start having issues. A man's heart is for his wife, and that is the way it ought to be. That's the reason the Bible says to those that are not married, who can devote their attention to the Lord, that is what they ought to do. Because if you have a wife, you're going to give attention to her that you can't give to the Lord. That's just the way it is. That's in 1 Corinthians. And the way it is supposed to be. The other side is the wife's interest in the husband. She lives for him. She wants to do for him. She wants to fix for him. She wants to have for him. She wants his favorite music. She wants to take him his coffee. She doesn't want him to get up and go get it. She wants to bring it to him. Now, you bigot man, whatever, how dare you? Look, I'm going to tell you, I don't have to ask my wife to do certain things. I don't mind doing them. I don't care. But she wants to do some things for me. I don't know why. I'm ugly and weird. But she does it anyway. I guess somewhere down in there, she loves me. Yesterday, she made some French press coffee, which is my favorite. I didn't ask her to do that. I had done some errands in the morning. And I was about to go down to begin third shift at Gators, whatever. And she said, I made some French press. Do you want some? I said, sure. You know, she brought me some. It's great. Or, you know, and then what's even better, by the way, you young back there, what's even better is when you get the kids. And then so you and your wife can just sit there, Jared, and come running. What's up, Dad? Make it sound like a big emergency, you know. Son, my water's empty. You know. That's awesome. I love it. Nice. Great stuff. Anyway, she wants to do those things. That is the wife. She loves him and she cares 100% everything for him. That is the way marriages work. It's when the wife gives everything to the husband gives everything to the wife. 100-100. The opposite of that, and sometimes it takes time to learn this, is selfishness. That is unselfishness. If a girl marries a boy because he can fix me up in life, or he can give me what I want, he can make me happy, they're heading for trouble before they ever say the marriage vows. It's about, because the perspective is, oh, I can marry him for what I'm going to get out of it. Do you see that? It's what I'm going to get. No, it's the wrong perspective. If she is not marrying, if she is not marrying, I guess, him so that she can make him the number one man in the world, she had better leave him alone and don't mess up his life. If you're not going to make him the number one man in the world, then don't get married. It's that simple. A wife is a crown to her husband. She is supposed to lift him up and exalt him and make him the greatest. That is what she's supposed to do. When a woman marries a man, she is to forget herself, and the same thing is true for her husband. When he takes a wife, he forgets himself, what he wants, what makes him comfortable. You ever made yourself uncomfortable for the comfort of your wife? You better. You better learn it quick. He has to forget about it and ask, what will she like? What would make her happy? What does she want? That kind of thing is what makes a wonderful, glorious marriage and just a growing and growing commitment constantly through life for each other. And you know why it works? It's because that's the example of Christ and the church. That's it. So what did, you know, what does she want? What does she like? You're like, all right, we're going to go out to eat. Where do you want to go? That's the greatest struggle of marriages probably in the history of marriage. I don't know. Where do you want? Oh, I'll eat anything. And then she'll say, well, no, that's not true. Because if I suggest this, then you'll turn your nose up at it. That's what my wife says. I was like, babe, I wouldn't do that. I really can eat anything tonight. And then she says something like, ugh. And she's like, see, I told you. Ah, yes, ma'am. Anyway, you know, what do you want? What pleases you? Paul Harvey, I don't even know who that is, used to give the steps of marriage. He would talk about the early years when you first get married and then the later years and so forth. But he talked about when you've been married 30 years. Listen now. Then real love sets in. Now, I'm not at 30 years yet. I just finished 20. And I'm going to tell you, I can say it beyond a shadow of a doubt. Matter of fact, I love my wife way. I can't count how many times more than when we were like puppy loved in high school. You know, that I get on Jared and Seth for. And then they're like, yeah, Dad, how about Mom told us about you? Oh, yeah. Anyway, you know, oh, I'm just head over heels. And oh, that ain't nothing. Excuse my Southern. That's nothing. And if you think that's what marriage is all about, you're in for a great surprise about how much more wonderful it will be. This is what happens a lot of times. Kids get divorced before they ever know what real love and marriage is and real happiness is. It doesn't set in till you've been married 25 or 30 years. Then it begins to be really, really wonderful. The whole thing is just so wonderful. Just being together and everything and enjoying each other's company is a joy in life, and it's just wonderful. That's Dr. Hobbs right there, what he said. And I keep that if you want to. I thought that was so good because we don't have a clue sometimes in our old fleshly little ways of looking at things. And I tell you, when we start learning to sacrifice for each other, then you really start seeing what love is. And the Lord blesses that. And then the kids come, and guess what? It's not easy. Now, there's one little thing that I could never do. My wife was very gracious to me. And that was, I could change wet diapers. But I'm telling you, you women are on a pedestal in my mind. Up here, because I get literally physically, I mean, I'm going to go throw up. I don't know how in the world. Tara, I don't know how y'all do it over there. I'm telling you, yes. And I remember when Seth was probably 1 year old, and we live in a little farmhouse out in the country. Every time we go home, sometimes I drive by and show the boys, that's where your mom and I lived when we first got married. And Seth remembers, he was three, I think, when we left. Two or three, but he remembers the fence in the backyard with the horses, and he actually remembers I was holding him, and we'd go up to the fence, and the horse would come up, and he'd reach over and pet the horse, and one time he reached out and grabbed the wire, you know, the electric wire, and both of us were like, and I was like, okay, we're good, woo, burned a few neurons off there, but we're all right. He remembers that. It is kind of funny. And some things are just, you know, traumatic in your life, shocking in your life, and you remember them for the rest of your life. Where I was going with this. Anyway, yeah, we were in this little farmhouse, and it was nice, little, basically one bedroom, a study, and a living room, and a little kitchen. My wife's countertops were the flat water heater, the stove, and there was one other thing in there, and that was her countertops. We didn't have the dishwashers and all that stuff. It was just an old little farmhouse. We loved it. Well, Megan decided that, you know, I was home. Wasn't working. I guess I'd gotten home one night from work, and she said, I got to go to Walmart and grab a few things. I was like, okay, great. Well, let me get Seth ready in the car seat. She said, oh, no. Uh-oh, what does that mean? And he was probably like 8 months old, I think. She said, I'm going by myself. I'm just going to run in. I'm going to haul the kid around. You just stay here with him. And you know, my first thought was, what if he goes poo-poo? She's like, well, change him. And I just started praying. I said, Lord, you have got to hold this boy's bowels for about 1 hour. I'm begging you, Lord, please, just give me an hour. And wouldn't you know it, 20 minutes in, and I mean, it's the mother load. I'm talking, how in the world can so much come out of that little boy, 8 month old? And I'll never forget it. I didn't know what to do. I laid him on the floor. I didn't know where else to change a diaper. I laid him on the floor and I started, I was just dying. And I got this big thing of wet wipes and I'm talking, you know, Megan, she just grabs his leg and holds him up and just whoosh, one wet wipe and her hand is spotless. And I'm going, so I was like, and threw it and it landed in a pile. Got another one and threw it and it landed. I had this big pile of used wet wipes. And finally, Seth was all cleaned up, got the diaper on him. And then I have to deal with this massive pile. And about that time, Megan walked in and said, "What in the world is going on in this house?" But I was not that good at that. I was terrible at it. Another thing that I'm terrible at is ironing. My wife doesn't like to iron as much. She's just like, "Oh, it's so tedious," but she does it. You know, and I was like, okay, I'm going to learn. I'm going to iron my shirt. It was the most disastrous event of my life. I was spraying stuff. I was going like this, and thought I was doing a great job. And I said, "Megan, I did it." And I held it up, and it was more wrinkled than when I started. I don't know how. Ironing is not my forte. My wife does my ironing for me. I'm absolutely terrible at it. I've tried, and every now and then I'll say, you know what? I'm going to try again. I've spent some time thinking through how I should do this, analyzing it. You know, that's the way I am, I guess. And I thought I had it figured out, and I go in there, and there's disaster number two. I've just given up on that. But, you know, we silly examples. We talk about that. You know, put your dish in the dishwasher or whatever little things. Do something. Help out. I get this joy out of fixing stuff at the house. John has taught me a few things. Like when the washer goes out, we had our dryer went out twice this year, and I was able to fix it both times with a little advice from the great John Gamble back there. Boy, that was great. I didn't have to go out and spend $1,000 on a dryer. Those people would have said, 10 years old, throw it. Nope, I'm going to keep it. Our refrigerator fan went out, took it apart, replaced the little fan, works, no problem. But by the way, guys, just learn to fix stuff. It's this thing, and we have no excuse today because it's called YouTube. You can literally type in the model number. Someone does have a detailed video out there, step by step, that even if you don't know what a screwdriver is, you can do it. So just a little side note, and I enjoy that kind of stuff, but you know, learn to serve each other. And what am I doing? I just thought that was so important. I wanted to go back and share that with you, what Dr. Hobbs has said back in 1984. And I think it's so true today and a blessing it could be to all of us, no matter how many years you've been married. Sacrifice for each other. And that is what Christ did for the church. But there's some of the things that we talked about. Purifying relationship, knowledgeable, honorable. Exclusive, we talked about that. Then I think we ended with this, and here's our last little thing. If our wives don't submit to the husbands and honor them, husbands don't love their wives and lead them, they'll push their children down the detour of rebellion and disobedience to God. If these marriages are in shambles, what do you think the kids are seeing? What are they learning about marriage? It's interesting, because I've seen it actually go both ways. I've seen disastrous marriages, and the kids are like, I know what my parents' marriage was like, and they divorced and remarried how many times. I'm not doing that. Sometimes it alternates generations. It's kind of weird. Like I said, my dad, his father was a horrible marriage example. My dad's probably the only one in his family of all the brothers and stepbrothers and five different divorces and remarriages and craziness. My grandfather didn't get saved until almost near the end of his life. My dad was able to lead him to Christ. But before then, it was just disaster. And my dad now is approaching 50 years of marriage. You look at his dad's example, you'd have thought, how in the world? Well, the grace of God. That's what my dad would tell you. It's God's grace can overcome that. But the probabilities are just not in the favor of children when they see those horrible examples of marriage relationships. Now, let's go ahead and go to the next one I want to put up, and I'm going to put several things up here on the board. It is disbelieving practices. When I as a parent have disbelieving practices, in other words, I may be saying that I'm a believer, and I'm talking the Christian talk, but my real life that my kids see at home is not what I say it is. Children see that. Some things here. The accumulation of habitual acts in time versus occasional acts. I want to talk about it. You say, well, how in the world are we going to be like, the power of example? So we're not perfect. Okay? Us parents, we make mistakes. We sin. Right? We've talked about it before. Sometimes you have to tell your children, I'm sorry, I did that wrong. You know, I've reacted wrong before. I've had to get things right with my wife or with my kids. It happens. You have to do that. But what we're not talking about is the things that we're talking about, a habitual lifestyle. And that's right from 1 John chapter 2, by the way. It talks about, you know, little children, these things I write unto you that you sin not. In the Greek, that is the present tense, ongoing sin. We are not to be in a life of ongoing sin. Then in verse number 2, it says, but if any man do sin, that's the aorist, which means a one-time action. It's an occasional thing. We do sin. We have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous, who forgives us. The point is, a believer doesn't live a habitual life of sin, but we do. We mess it up, don't we? The flesh gets in there, and our ideas get in there, and our pride is the big one. It gets in there, and there's sin. But we have an advocate with the Father, and we better go to Him and get those things repented and forgiven. So, there, what is our habitual life like? Let's look at 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse number 12. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse number 12. As you're turning there, think about some of the things. What kind of disbelieving practices could we be talking about here? Like, you know, we hear the preacher saying something about whatever, and we say, amen, in front of our kids at church, but then meanwhile at home they know that we actually do the complete opposite. Or, you know, you get your child and you spank him for lying and get all over him for being a liar, but yet the child watches as you lie to your neighbor, next door neighbor, or twist the truth a little bit, or make promises you never intend to keep. They notice that. Or, you know, pretending at church that everything is fine between mom and dad and then going home and arguing all the time. Kids see that. They see that. Disbelieving practices. Making choices only on the basis of money, or, you know, taking credit for all the good things and blaming God for all the bad stuff. The kids see those kind of things. Requiring your children to obey, and then you go out and do whatever you want. You know, no, it doesn't matter, whatever. Kids see the difference, is what I'm trying to say, between what we profess and what we actually do. And over a period of time, if it's with repetition, if it's the habit to have this type of disbelieving practices where you don't match what you say you are, over time, these negative examples will strongly influence children away from a life of faith. And there are numerous studies. Because back, 10, 15 years ago, people started noticing all the young people were leaving church. Okay? They were growing up in church and then running. And I tell you, I hate to say it, but a lot of times, we're to blame for that. We're to blame for that. With what goes on. Now, I know children make their own choices, but a lot of times, what did we do to influence them down that? I tell you, even as an administrator or a teacher, you know, one of the things I love teaching kids, I love it. I love being in there with them. I miss it. I wish sometimes I could do that full time again. Just to be in there with the young people and have an influence in their life and point them to the Lord. But one of the greatest disappointments and hardest things that makes you just not want to do it anymore is when the young people reject everything and go out and live a terrible life. You know, I'm telling you, I take that personally. It's one of the biggest burdens of my life. And I always think back and I say, Lord, what could I have done differently? And then you start to remember little things. What about in that situation when I should have said this, but instead I gave this advice? Or I said this or acted this way when I should have acted this way. So how did my example hurt that child? That is a weight like a ton that hangs over every teacher, every administrator, whatever. It's there. Because we want to see them come to Christ. And Lord, is my inadequacy, is my sin, is my, maybe I've got some secrets in there somewhere perhaps. Or the things I do that I shouldn't have done, or the things I said that I shouldn't have said, did I influence them away? Children see, don't misunderstand me, because here's one of the biggest reasons when I talk to people about, you know, hey, what's going on with your life in the Lord? And again, some people say, well, you know, Some people say things like, well, you stop going, you need to get in church. Well, I tell you what, you know, that's true, but being in church ain't going to fix the problem. Don't misunderstand me. The probability of them coming back to the Lord or whatever is higher. Yes, they need to be under the sound of the gospel, but there's a heart problem there that needs to be dealt with. And just coming up and putting some fake appearance in church ain't going to fix it. Don't throw a hymn book at me. Need to be in church because they're going to hear the gospel and the power of the gospel can do things. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of them that just come and put on a fake front. Then they're just there. Or maybe it's us. We're just there. Yeah, I was there, but I slept through every service. Well, then what's the point? Don't tell somebody that, well, they're not in church, but we sit there and sleep or pay a daydream and do whatever the whole time. We're just as bad then. But these behaviors, and the children see this type of thing. And young people, their typical comeback is, well, say, why? Well, there's a bunch of hypocrites in the church. Okay, that's probably true. It's probably true. I've been going to church since I was literally born. And guess what? Shocker, there's a lot of hypocrites in church. That's just fact. And I tell people, I hear them say that, I say, well, that might be true. Okay, number one, I'd suggest you find a different church. Because, you know, no church is perfect. I tell them that. No church is perfect. But then I tell them this. Just because there's hypocrites in a church doesn't excuse you from what your relationship with God is. You still have to stand before God, and He's not going to ask you about what the hypocrites did. There's fake people everywhere. If you haven't realized that, especially the ones that call you sweetie or bless your heart while they stab you in the back, and you know, and we live in the South, and oh, you know, sometimes I went to go up there with Chris and Brenda DeMaine, and they just tell you like it is. You know, oh, that hurt, but hey, it's true. I needed to hear it. You know, there's a lot. Sometimes you miss that because they're, oh, how are you doing? That's wonderful. And okay, good. Anyway, they see that. Children see that. They see the hypocrisy. They see the inconsistent double standards. They see all that. Okay, but you can't let that deter you or get you off of serving God and having your heart right with God. Doesn't matter if people are hypocrites. Doesn't matter if they want to live some big fake life. You are accountable and responsible to know, am I trusting in the Lord? I'm going to worry about my spiritual life and that of my family, and I'm going to worship the Lord, and I'm going to go anyway, and I'm going to follow in the truth of God. That's what it should be. But, you know, we look for excuses, and young people today look for excuses. It's sad, and it's true. And so, again, it's something that Pastor always talks about and reminds me quite frequently of is we got to keep the moral high ground. Okay? The moral high ground. And as a parent, ought to be living in such a way, like I said, why would I punish my child for lying if my child knows I'm a liar? But my son, what do you think the kids are seeing? Don't preach to them about don't go out drinking and partying when you're bringing it into the house. I mean, thought. What do you expect? They will do what you set for them before them. They'll do it. And if we have disbelieving practice, an accumulation of bad example can hurt a child. Now, some children, they can overcome it by the grace of God, even bad parenting, they can overcome it. So 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12 says, let no man despise thy youth, be an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity. All of these different things we could spend a lot of time talking about, and we'll talk about the purity of example and things like that. But be an example, the idea is a mold or a pattern. You know, my wife does this crocheting, okay? It just absolutely boggles my mind. It's a different language. I don't know if any of y'all have ever crocheted. I know Tara's like, mm-hmm. Grover and I, we've done quite a bit, and we're going to teach young Jake back there how to do it as well. We know the language pretty good. There's all these X, 2, Y, Z, up, down, over. And she's just sitting there. And I'm like, what is going on over here? And she's just happy, just... oh, relaxing crocheting. I'm like, that does not look relaxing to me. My brain's about to fry. I don't know what you're doing. But there's a pattern there, and she follows it and chain this and key that. I don't know all this stuff she's doing. And then now she's gotten so good, she can just look at something and make it. So she makes these little stuffed animals, crochets them. She makes little any little character, and then she can sell them to these kids at school or whatever for the senior trip and all that kind of stuff. And she just loves it. She looks at it like, oh, I can make that dinosaur. Oh, is that what that is? Okay. I would not have done that. But anyway, it's kind of neat. She has a pattern. And then from the pattern, you produce. When I was a kid, we had those Estes model cars. Anybody else have those? I absolutely love the little plastic model cars. And we had the spray paint kit and the little lacquer paint that smelled. We probably all had brain cancer. We're in our room, me and the boys. My dad had built us this long workbench in our room. We thought it was just heaven in there. And we got our model cars out. And I remember Aaron, my brother, had a Dodge Stealth. That was a car back in the 90s for you young ones that don't know. It was a pretty cool car back then. And it was his favorite car. Dad bought him the kit. And he had every detail painted. I mean, every detail of the engine and glued everything. It was perfect. But he had an instruction, a pattern of what to do. Or maybe building Legos or whatever the kids do. If you have a pattern, use the pattern to produce this. The pattern that I'm putting out there, what it says, let no man be an example. The pattern that I'm putting out there is going to be picked up. It's going to be followed. So be a mold or a pattern. And it says, don't let them despise. Let no man despise your youth. That means to think against. Thought is the seed of rebellion. Once you think about that, young people especially, or even us with our little ways with the Lord that we do, where does it all start? Right here. I preach a lot to the kids in chapel, in high school and so forth, that about the mind, the battlefield of the mind. To me, it's one of the most important because that's where everything starts. The rebellion, the rejection. I've heard from my parents. I've heard from the church. I've heard from school. I've heard from whatever, you know, the good examples. I've heard and I know the truth and I know the gospel, but I think this. You know, our world is full of the, well, I think, I believe this. I look at it this way. Nobody cares. God doesn't care what way you decided to look at it. He cares what's in this book. And is my thinking lined up with it? But, you know, we don't do that anymore. So we think in different directions. And that causes rejection. Home behavior and outside behavior must be consistent because what we do will reveal what we really believe. I can say whatever I want to say, but what I do shows what I believe, and that's scary. That's heavy. That's a burden. That's what we've got to pray and say, Lord, help me to have my thinking right. That I don't, again, yes, we have the occasional. We all do. But what God, we can't have this habitual life of sin because the Bible's clear about that. If we're living a habitual life of sin, 1 John says we're walking in darkness and we don't have the light. Now, that's a God question. God knows who's truly saved and who's not. We can evaluate some things and make a judgment about some things, but God knows. I tell you right now, I would have never told you that Lot was saved and I would have never said David would have been saved. I'll tell you that. Man that murders and is an adulterer, full of pride. Buddy, we'd have cut that dude off long. It would have been done. But you know what? He was a man after God's own heart. It's the occasional versus the habitual. The occasional is bad enough when you get it right with God. But habitual, anyway, we better be careful about our practices. And maybe on some Sunday nights or so forth, we'll pick up on some of this. I'd like to get it done. I get too bogged down and distracted, and maybe that's why the kids like it when I teach. It's Rabbit Trail 101. Anyway, I've enjoyed this month, and I hope it's been a blessing to you. Father, just thank you for this time this morning. And Lord, help our marriages. They would be biblical. Thank you for what we read this morning, even from Dr. Hobbs, way back in 1984. Lord, I just thank you for that. It's probably about almost 40 years ago. And Lord, I ask that we would be 100% in our marriage, not some 50-50 or thinking that it's all about me. Help us, Father, in that. And then help our practices, that they would be believing practices, not disbelieving practices. And you'd honor your word through this. I thank you now and bless our service in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.